The Undertaker against Sonny Trout. Think things are going to get a little fishy in the ring?
What, are you trying to catch me on one, McMahon?
Forget about it.
Nah, you're way too sharp for anyone to catch.
Right. Don't try dropping a line on me.
Reeling one in.
You're a castaway.
Why don't you go put a worm on your hook or something, huh?
What, are you trying to lure me in?
No, you're... Well, you work for scale or what?
Not unlike you, McMahon. I work for more than just a fin.
Holy mackerel.
Boy, you better go back to school.
I suppose so. Then again, that's a whale of a statement, isn't it?
You didn't say that on purpose, did you?
Well, then again, there you go, changing your tuna.
That was from a match between The Undertaker and Sonny Trout from Superstars back in 1992. Some entertaining wordplay between Vince McMahon and the late Kurt Hennig. This is the Sound Off, episode 162, here on SCScoops.com. It is Sunday, June 5th, 2011. Want to give a quick birthday shout-out, special top-of-the-show birthday shout-out to Webmaster Mike. Hope he's having a good birthday. I'm sure he's listening. Can't think of a better birthday gift than the Sound Off. First things first, I was asked if I had seen the new Hangover movie, Part 2, and I had every expectation of seeing it. The first movie is still one of the funniest films I've ever seen. But the reason I bring this up is because for those of you who've seen the movie, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. In the movie, there is a character named Alan, played by Zach Galifianakis, and his character in the movie is a bit of a man-child, is probably a good way of describing him. And in one particular scene in this movie, his friends are invited up into his room. And in his room are just dozens of wrestling posters from the 1980s. And he has a huge collection of old WWF LJN figures on display. It was actually quite a sight. And obviously in the movie they're playing it, you know, as wrestling fans or losers. At least his character in the movie, it's kind of portrayed that way. But what was eerie about the scene was one of the posters on the wall in his room was of the Macho Man, Randy Savage. And this poster was actually in the backdrop of the scene. You know, they put the camera on this character. And in the background, you could see the Savage poster quite a bit, more so than any of the other posters in this particular scene. I mean, the Savage one probably was on screen in total for over 30 seconds. And I just thought that was a tad bit eerie in light of recent events. Obviously, this movie was filmed some time ago, but Macho Man continues to get press on a very big scale, more so than perhaps any other wrestler in history. So for those of you who are interested, it's a funny movie, if you, by the way, if you wanted to see it. I give it a hearty recommendation, unlike X-Men, which I saw and did not like. So just figured I would throw that out there. If anybody was thinking about seeing either of those two movies, that's what I thought of them. All right, on to wrestling stuff here, the matters that, of course, are most important. We are coming up on the finale of Tough Enough, the season finale of Tough Enough on USA. This Monday night is the final episode. You will see taped footage that was taped a couple weeks back, actually several weeks ago, at Florida Championship Wrestling, the developmental territory for WWE. And so I guess FCW will make its unofficial national debut on TV this week. They're going to show footage of some matches that the finalists, including Luke and Andy, the two finalists on this season of Tough Enough, they competed in matches at FCW some time ago. They got some training from Ricky the Dragon Steamboat, who I guess will make an appearance on this episode as the final legend here on the final episode. And so we'll get to see that on the finale this week. But the episode from last Monday was another good one. And we saw the elimination of Jeremiah Riggs, who, of course, is the MMA fighter with no teeth. Had a lot of personality, great charisma, you know, okay in the ring. Didn't have a whole lot of wrestling experience prior to this. And it was obvious that Steve Austin really liked Jeremiah. But when it comes right down to it, it's not a popularity contest. And you got to go with your better hand. And Jeremiah was simply not that person. So he got eliminated last week. So like I said, two people left. It's going to come down to Luke and Andy, and I've said all along that Luke was going to be in the finals and would probably win the whole thing, and I'm still fairly confident of that. I know Andy is a big guy, and we know Vince McMahon and WWE, they love their big guys, but the thing about Andy that you got to remember is, as big as he is, I think, I looked it up, I think he's only about 6'4", maybe 6'5", and don't get me wrong, that's a big guy, but he looks big, excuse me, he looks bigger than he is on Tough Enough because there's nobody quite like him in terms of size and stature. If he makes it to WWE, you've got more than your fair share of guys that are well bigger than 6'5". So all of a sudden, Andy goes from looking like a really, really big guy to just an average guy. And when you take away his size, is he really anything special? The answer is no. If anything, he's too soft. So I stick to my guns here. Luke is going to win the whole thing. Not that Luke is blowing me away. Actually, nobody this season really blew me away, but Luke is clearly the one who I think is being positioned to win. I don't think the fix is in or anything like that, but he's very easy to hate, and I think he's more advanced at this point than pretty much everybody else on the show. So we'll find out what the end result of all this is. Still no word on whether or not there's going to be a second season of Tough Enough. Steve Austin's tweeted about it. He said he's waiting to hear back, and I, for one, hope the show comes back. I've really, really enjoyed this season. Again, Tough Enough was what NXT should have been, and to some degree what NXT was supposed to be before they changed their minds at the last minute. Again, remember that first season of NXT, they taped a whole bunch of footage with Daniel Bryan and Wade Barrett and all the people on that show, that they were going to make it more of, I don't want to say a documentary-style show, but whatever the case may be, they changed their minds, and we ended up getting what we got with NXT. And some of the NXT seasons have been entertaining, others have not. I have paid zero attention to the NXT season on WWE.com once it went off TV. Not that my interest was so high even then, but I just completely lost all interest in that show, and I have no idea what's going on. So, Tough Enough, thumbs up. Hope they bring the show back, and we'll check out the finale this week. Again, Austin is going to be on Raw this Monday night, I believe. He'll also be on Raw next week on June 13th at Nassau Coliseum. I don't know if it's going to be a situation where this week we find out the winner of Tough Enough, and then perhaps next Monday they have their first match on Raw. Perhaps that's why Austin will be there 2 weeks in a row. Otherwise, why is Austin on Raw 2 weeks in a row? It seems to be the one thing that would make sense, so I guess we'll find out. Raw last Monday, plagued with technical difficulties to start off the show. It's been a while since we've seen that Please Stand By graphic when we've had technical difficulties. And all I could think when I was watching the beginning of the show was, we see R-Truth on the concourse by one of the merchandise stands, and he's cutting a promo, and he's walking into the arena, and all I could think is, R-Truth's promos have been probably the best part of Raw for several weeks now. So this may well be the best segment on the show. It may not get much better from here. And we can't hear a goddamn thing. Then the audio came back, and then the video didn't match the audio, and it felt like I was watching a YouTube video, and then they finally got it fixed. So, shit happens, but I just... Why couldn't it happen during, like, a Divas match or something? Had to happen during R-Truth's promo. I liked the show. I thought, you know, overall it was a good show. It wasn't great, but I have been very unimpressed by Raw now for the last couple of weeks. This show, better than those shows. Just a couple of random observations here, things that I like and I don't like. I don't like the fact... Now, actually, let me start by saying this. I do like and appreciate the fact that it appears this feud, this never-ending feud with Jerry Lawler and Michael Cole, has finally come to its conclusion, as it should have, probably a lot earlier than it did. I like that. I believe me, I'm very happy that it's over. However, the best that they can do is have Michael Cole just come back to the announce table, beg for forgiveness in a very unconvincing manner, by the way. I'm still not convinced that Cole won't turn on Lawler at some point. But basically, the two of them are sitting there during the show all chummy like they're best friends and nothing ever happened. I mean, they did reference Cole kissing Lawler's foot at one point. But still, I mean, it was as though all of that shit that we sat through for months never happened. And I just couldn't help but think that there's got to be a more creative way to go about doing this. Or, of course, you can always move Cole somewhere else and put Jim Ross back with Jerry Lawler, but obviously they don't want to do that. We had Karma come out. This was, of course, a big subject of conversation. We knew that Karma was going to come out on Raw Monday and cut a promo. We didn't know what she was going to say. We didn't know what she was going to do. But we had heard the news that she was pregnant. She was, as she said on TV, with child, and would be off television probably for the better part of a year. And she came out, and the route that they decided to go was to simply have her come out and, in effect, cut almost a shoot promo and just explain to the audience that she's pregnant and she's going to have to go away for a while. And, of course, this was a big departure from the kind of character that she's been portraying on television now since she started. She hasn't spoken yet. All we've seen her do is come out and beat the crap out of all the Barbie doll divas in WWE. And they've really done a very, very effective job of building her up between her music and her entrance and her actions as a monster. And I've seen a lot of opinions thrown back and forth about the Karma situation and people berating WWE. How could they have her go out there and ruin the entire character? They've done such a good job of building her up as a monster, and now she's just like any other diva. She came out and she's human. It was almost a babyface like reaction that she was getting. I mean, she was cutting this promo explaining that she tried out for WWE on the second season of Tough Enough, and Jim Ross said she was too fat, which, of course, is the classic example of the pot calling the kettle black. Jim Ross denies that this happened, regardless, even if the story was embellished for storyline purposes, and it was Vince McMahon fucking around with Jim Ross, which, of course, he loves to do. She explained that she went all over the world. She scrubbed floors in Japan in the dojos, the Japanese dojos, and she, of course, didn't mention TNA by name, but she mentioned competing all over the world. And she had two dreams, one of which was to have a kid, the other to make it to WWE. And she was able to accomplish both dreams in this calendar year, and she was very proud. She would be back. This is not the last that we've seen of her. And then the Bella Twins came out, and they start cutting this promo, of course, basically calling her fat and ugly. And Karma, of course, is pregnant, so there was no physicality, but she did threaten the Bellas and said that if they're still around in a year when she gets back, which I thought was kind of funny, that she would say, if they're still around, she was going to be coming for them. Karma's a bitch, and the Bellas would get payback. And so and the fans cheered. You know, all of a sudden, this woman went from being a heel, and there were people cheering her, don't get me wrong, but clearly she was being portrayed as a heel. And all of a sudden, she's perhaps the biggest babyface diva in the entire company in one night. Here's my take on this, and I have a little bit of a different opinion on this. I would argue that Karma leaving right now may actually be the best thing that could have happened. And I'll tell you why. Now, they have an entire year to build up at least one or two credible threats to her upon her return. Explain to me where this angle was going. I've enjoyed it thus far, but you cannot deny the fact that, aside from perhaps Beth Phoenix, maybe Eve, although I wouldn't even go that far, Natalia, you can argue, but they have done a piss-poor job of building her up as anything special. Aside from Beth Phoenix, who among the divas on their roster right now could be seen as a potential credible threat? And don't tell me Gail Kim, because I know Gail Kim had that wonderful feud with Kong and TNA, and they had some great matches. It's obvious that Gail Kim was not going to feud with Awesome Kong here. Or, if there was going to be any interaction, she was going to be the next victim that got an implant buster in the middle of the ring. Okay, WWE was not going to do anything with Gail Kim, or they would have teased something between them by now, and they've done shit. So don't tell me Gail Kim. They don't have anybody, again, except possibly Beth Phoenix, on the roster right now that could be seen as a credible threat to this woman. Their Divas division is in shambles. It sucks. And at some point, this angle was going to run out of steam. You can only have Karma come out so many weeks and do the same thing over and over and over again. At some point, she has to wrestle. At some point, we as fans have to believe that there is somebody on this roster, there is somebody in this company, who could give her a run for her money. And I would argue that person right now does not exist. So, I look at this as a positive. Now she gets to go away for 9, 10, 12 months, and you've got an entire year to get your shit together and to add one or two new faces to the roster, or build up some divas right now to a point where when she does come back, she'll have some credible opponents. I think it's a good thing. Now, is WWE going to actually do this? Of course not. Of course they're not. Because to them, it's not a priority. But that's how they should look at it. They should look at it as a positive and not a negative. And by the way, when the Bella Twins were making fun of Karma, and Lawler, you know, on commentary, Jerry Lawler got that very kind of subdued tone in his voice, and he said, that's not right, because they were making fat jokes about her. All of a sudden, fat jokes are no good for Jerry Lawler when he comes on television every week and makes fun of Vicky Guerrero for being fat, when in fact Vicky Guerrero isn't even fat anymore. Explain to me the hypocrisy to that. I could not believe that Lawler was offended that they were insulting Karma about her weight. That was just stupid. So, then we have Michael Cole in the ring to interview Alex Riley. And Cole mentions that Alex Riley apparently, if I understood correctly, has been drafted back to Raw by the anonymous Raw general manager. What? I don't think Alex Riley made a single appearance on SmackDown. I mean, maybe he might have made an appearance, but I am almost 100% convinced that he did not wrestle a single match since he was, quote, drafted over to SmackDown in the draft back in, what, April? All of a sudden, he's back on Raw? What was the point of that in the first place? I mean, oh boy. Well, you know what? Why do I even bother making a fuss about this anymore? None of this shit matters anyway, so I shouldn't really bother complaining about it. Riley, once again, he got the best of The Miz on this show. And he was left standing tall at the end of this segment. Miz came out to attack him, got the better of him, and at that point you figure, okay, Miz is going to get his heat back, and so it's the even Steven booking in WWE where, you know, 1 week one guy wins, and the next week another guy wins, and nothing really ever changes. But in this case, Alex Riley fought back and got the better of The Miz for the second week in a row, a former WWE champion. You know, say what you want to about The Miz, and he's not quite on the same level as a John Cena or a Steve Austin or The Rock, but, you know, they built The Miz up as a main event guy. You know, he headlined WrestleMania, former WWE champion. Alex Riley getting one over on him 2 weeks in a row is kind of a big deal, and I'm somewhat surprised to see them building Riley up as strongly as they have. 2 weeks is a small sample size. I mean, a lot can go wrong in the next couple of weeks, but, you know, Riley got a pretty good reaction from the crowd, and all I can say is so far so good. See if they can keep it up. The main event was fine. You know, this is your next pay-per-view main event. R-Truth and John Cena, which I'm very happy about, by the way, that we're going to get that match at Capital Punishment. But, you know, to give this match away for, you know, for free, there was no advance notice about it or build-up or anything like that. Ordinarily, that would be pretty goddamn stupid, and you can say that it was here, too, but they kept it short. I mean, the match literally went, what, 2 minutes, 3 minutes, maybe? I don't think it went much more than that. So, I'm actually fine with that, because they kept it short. R-Truth didn't lose anything from it, and, you know, let's be honest about this, okay? 2 weeks from now, people will not even remember that this happened. Basically, they had a match, and R-Truth could not get the better of Cena. And it looked like Cena was well on his way to victory, and R-Truth kept rolling out of the ring. And again, I have no problem with that. That's a classic heel tactic, to roll out of the ring and stall. You know, guys like Ted DiBiase used to do that all the time back in the day. You roll out of the ring, you get your composure, you go back in. Cena, if I remember correctly, Cena came out after him. They ended up in the crowd, and I think what happened is R-Truth kind of suckered Cena and delivered a shot to the face and jumped back in the ring just in time to avoid the countout, and R-Truth wins the match via countout. So, lame finish? Absolutely. But again, they kept it short. It was intended not to be a real match. It was intended to build some more heat between the two of them heading into the pay-per-view. I would not have necessarily done this, but I see, you know, people saying that, oh, it's so terrible and this and that. We've seen far worse from WWE. Just the mere fact that they've actually put R-Truth in a pay-per-view main event tells me that they realize he's getting over. You and I know that he's getting over, but remember, these people are stupid. They don't quite understand that all the time. Just because the fans react a certain way doesn't mean they're going to do the right thing, but they seem to be doing the right thing so far. So this main event here, it was a shitty main event, but I was fine with it. It was what it was. I cannot complain. And as far as the end of the show, you know, they had that planted fan in the crowd, and he was a plant. He's a local theater actor in the area. The guy that was there with his son in the audience, it was the same person who R-Truth grabbed, I guess, some soda and splashed it in his face at the end of the show. And let's be honest with each other here. R-Truth did what we have all wanted to do at one point or another to a fan wearing a John Cena t-shirt. And got away with it. So God bless R-Truth. I have not seen SmackDown yet. I did see the last 10 minutes of SmackDown, which is probably the only part that really matters. Although apparently Cody Rhodes and Ted DiBiase are back together, which I haven't seen their segment yet. That intrigues me a little bit, just because I know they had a match a couple of weeks ago, and, you know, Cody beat DiBiase, and that was basically the end of it. So I don't know exactly why they're back together, but I did see the end of the show. It was Orton and Sheamus in a match with Christian as the referee. Teddy Long was being an asshole and refusing to give Christian another shot. I know that in theory, Christian lost twice in a row, fair and square. He got his rematch. He probably doesn't deserve another title shot in storyline, but come on. They've put on two of the best matches all year long on WWE television. Give the people what they want. But Teddy Long has to be a douchebag. He refuses to put Christian in the title match and says, you can be a referee. And so Christian officiates the match. Orton gets the victory. And then after the match, Christian wallops Randy Orton with the World Heavyweight Championship belt. And voila, you have the long-anticipated Christian heel turn. Or do we? I am not 100% sure that that's what that was supposed to be. I mean, I assume it was a heel turn, and perhaps we'll get some sort of inspired heel-like promo from Christian next week on TV, but perhaps it was just, you know, another chapter in the Orton-Christian feud, you know, Christian playing mind games on Orton and just showing him that he's not ready to give up and he wants another title shot, and all I'm saying is I'm not sure this was a full-fledged heel turn. It looked like it, but we'll see. Next week. The key is in the follow-up and what they do with Christian next week. If Christian comes out on TV next week and starts berating the fans and saying the fans turn their back on him, which I don't see how they can do that because the fans have, in my opinion, the fans have very much been behind Christian. But if he starts ragging on the fans and all that, then we know he's officially a heel. And if he comes out next week and doesn't do that and gets pretty good cheers from the crowd and simply says, you know, Randy, nothing personal, but, you know, I did what I did last week because I want you to know that I want another title shot and I'm willing to do whatever I need to do to get it. That doesn't signify heel to me. So let's not jump the gun quite yet on it, but nonetheless, when he hit Orton with the title, I smiled. And Christian does play heel a lot better than he plays babyface, and Christian is a pretty damn good babyface. So what that tells you is he's an awesome heel. And I hope that's the direction they're going, and obviously this will lead to at least one more pay-per-view match between the two of them, and the winners in all this are you and I, because whoever watches that match, I'm sure, is going to be very entertained. The two of them have great chemistry in the ring. It takes two to tango. I give Randy Orton a lot of credit. I find him to be quite boring in many of his matches, but Christian seems to bring the best out of him, and they've got great chemistry. They've had two fantastic matches. And personally, I'd like to see Christian finally get a win over Orton, even if he has to cheat, because that's what heels do. That's fine. Put the title back on Christian, and then have Orton chase Christian for the belt. You know, if they do that, then I can forgive them for what they did to Christian after Extreme Rules. Because, you know, again, the key back then was they took the title away from Christian. They didn't even give him a chance to defend it beyond that first week. And, you know, we didn't know if this meant that Christian was just going to be pushed back down into the mid-card and forgotten, or if this was going to mean even bigger things for him. And so far, it's meant big things for him in that he is still involved in a main event storyline with the world champion. You don't have to actually have the strap around your waist to be in a main event position. And Christian has pretty much stayed at that level. And as long as he continues to feud with Orton, we know he's going to stay at that level. That's a good thing. So, very happy to see that on Friday night. And I'm sure many of you read the news that was posted on SE Scoops about the rib that was played on poor Mark Henry after the show. And so you don't need me to recount the whole story. Basically, there was supposed to be a dark match, I believe, between Orton and Henry, or the two of them were supposed to be involved in some sort of dark match. And Mark Henry came out, and his opponent was supposed to come out and didn't for about 10 minutes straight. Mark Henry is in the ring, standing there waiting for his opponent to come out. And then finally they play Hornswoggle's theme music, and he doesn't come out. And they play Vince McMahon's theme music, and he doesn't come out. And I guess Mark Henry didn't take it very well. He was quite pissed off. He finally, after about 20 minutes of this bullshit, stormed backstage and was livid over being pranked. And my take on it is this. That's fine. They can do stuff like that if they want to. Whatever. But you're really fucking over your fans by doing that. You have people in the building. I mean, people are leaving, but there's still a lot of people that stick around for those dark matches. You promise them a dark match. It's probably after 11 o'clock at night already. They're waiting around. They've got work the next day or school the next day. And you fuck with them by not giving them what you promised. And you basically waste everybody's time. You want to waste Mark Henry's time and play a joke on him, that's fine. Do that backstage. Keep that shit behind the scenes. You know, if I was a fan of the audience during this, and I didn't know what the fuck was going on, and I didn't know that they were playing a joke on Mark Henry, and there was no punchline to the joke. I mean, if they would have kept everybody waiting around for 25 minutes and then did something at the end to make people smile, that's fine. But apparently they did nothing. Mark Henry stormed backstage, and Tony Chimmel got on the microphone and said, "See you later, have a good night." That's pretty fucked up. That's pretty fucked up. So, not cool on WWE's part. If I were in the building that night, I'd be pretty pissed off about that. I talked last week, or maybe it was the week before, about bragging rights being no more. They have dropped the bragging rights pay-per-view concept and replaced it with vengeance. Actually, they replaced it with Uprising, and then they realized after the fact that Uprising is the name, I believe, of a Dragon Gate USA pay-per-view show. So they've gone back to the well to the old Vengeance name, and that'll be your October, one of your October pay-per-views in addition to Hell in a Cell. For the people who have asked, I don't believe they have a title yet for their September pay-per-view. Because if you go to the schedule on WWE.com, they have the pay-per-view events listed pretty much through the end of the year, and September is still blank. And I'm fairly certain they will be having a pay-per-view that month. So for the people who have asked me, I just don't know what the name of it is going to be. But the point is, they've dropped bragging rights, and now we found out that SmackDown vs. Raw, the video game franchise, there have been a ton of SmackDown vs. Raw video games over the last several years. They have a new one every year that comes out. It is no more. It is now WWE 12, as in WWE 2012. And I guess they'll update it each year with whatever year it is, kind of like they do with the Madden NFL video games. I don't care either way. I'm not a video gamer like I used to be. I think maybe I played the first or maybe the second SmackDown vs. Raw video game that ever came out a couple of times, and that was pretty much it. The extent of my gaming now is pretty much limited to my iPhone 4. I've got a shit ton of games on there. NBA Jam and EA Sports MMA fighting game, and just put Street Fighter 4 on there. Angry Birds, that's the extent of my gaming. So to me, I could give a fuck. But the reason they were keeping bragging rights around all this time was because they used it as a promotional vehicle for the SmackDown vs. Raw video game. And so now that bragging rights is no more, and they don't really care to push the idea of Raw vs. SmackDown. Why? Because they realize people do not give a shit about it because they did such a piss-poor job of making it feel special. So the video game went bye-bye. They came up with a new name for it. And I feel vindicated because, see, I was right. The draft really does not mean a goddamn thing, and people know it. And that's why this happened. So the brand warfare concept was an epic fail. It didn't have to be. But again, WWE treated it like a joke. Who could possibly take seriously any sort of Raw versus SmackDown feud? I mean, really, come on. I mean, it would be like the Walmart in Paducah, Kentucky, feuding with the Walmart in Lexington, Kentucky. What sense does it make? It's all the same. It's still Walmart. It's one fucking company, and everybody knows it. So, anyway, that's the update on that. Now, let's move on to TNA. Some big TNA news this week. Mick Foley is apparently done with TNA Wrestling. Mere weeks after being revealed as the network representative, he is gone. So, typical TNA. My understanding is this. Foley had mentioned many months ago that his TNA deal was going to be expiring late in 2011. I believe it's September, I think, is when his deal runs out. And he was, even back then, teasing the idea that he didn't know if he was going to re-sign. And to me, the things he was saying, he wasn't saying he was definitely going to leave and go back to WWE, but my sense was that it was exactly what he was thinking. You know, especially after Vince McMahon, he was really touched by the idea that Vince McMahon would plug his new book on their TV show, on Raw and SmackDown, while Foley was under contract to TNA. And I think that one act on Vince McMahon's part was so shrewd. And now things are looking so much clearer to me now, all these months later, because people at the time were asking, why would Vince McMahon do this? Why would Vince McMahon allow his announcers to promote Mick Foley's latest book, Countdown to Lockdown, a book that has a TNA pay-per-view name in its title on Raw and SmackDown? And on WWE.com, Joey Styles did an interview with Mick Foley for the website. And people were just flabbergasted at the time. How is this possible? Why would Vince McMahon allow something like this to happen? Maybe he's going soft. He's just being a nice guy. Now we see things for how they really are. And I don't think I'm reading too much into this. I think I have found the method to Vince McMahon's madness for when he did that all those months ago. Because to me, there is no doubt in my mind now that when Foley is truly done with TNA, the question is, are they going to let him out of his contract early? Are they going to hold him to it until September and then he's free to do what he wants? We don't know the answer to that yet. But it looks like he's done with TNA, and in my opinion, he's on his way back to WWE. In what capacity? I don't know. They could certainly use somebody for the anonymous Raw general manager role. You know, I'm sure they're going to want to put Foley in the Hall of Fame at some point. There's a lot of things I'm sure they'd like to do with him, even if he's not on television every week. I have no doubt that Foley will be back in the WWE family before this year is over. Apparently, he gave notice to the company. He specifically asked to be released from his contract. He cited creative differences with the people who run the company. No big surprise there. And on Impact Wrestling this week, I can't call it that. It's I saw some of Impact this week. It's the same goddamn garbage that we see every other week. What is different about this show? I admit, I didn't see the whole show. I didn't see last week's show at all. I saw the week before that, I did see part of that show. So I have not seen every complete Impact since the change. I've seen bits and pieces. So perhaps I'm wrong. You tell me if I'm wrong. I don't think I am. Every review that I read of the show, because, you know, when I miss it and I don't watch it on TV, I at least read the reviews to know the results and I know what's going on. This is the same fucking show that it was before the name change. It's just amazing to me that people actually fell for it again. I didn't. I know many of you didn't. Some people did. I had people angrily writing into me at the time when I was being skeptical about the change. You're not giving TNA a chance. SE Scoops is in the tank for WWE. Shut the fuck up. First of all, you sound like an idiot when you say that. SE Scoops is not in the tank for anybody. I am not in the tank for anybody. Okay? You sound like Jesse Ventura and his wild conspiracy theories. Just shut up. You make yourself look and sound stupid when you say that. I say the things I say about TNA because it's true. And the people who are fans of TNA who take such great offense to these things that I say and other people say and they think we're being overly negative, it drives them nuts. It drives them nuts because they're drinking the Kool-Aid and I'm not. TNA does not know what the fuck it's doing. They promoted this big change. They put the word wrestling. Wrestling matters. They said over and over and over again, wrestling matters, wrestling matters, wrestling matters. And what do we see on Impact this week? Again, Hulk Hogan, Eric Bischoff, they're in the ring talking, they're backstage talking or on the phone talking and talking and talking. And they come out, and they got a thing from the network, and Mick Foley is fired. Who gives a shit? I mean, really, is anybody supposed to care about any of this at all? Where's the wrestling they told us about? Where's the wrestling? I don't know where it is. So then Eric Bischoff goes on Twitter, actually earlier in the week. Now again, Eric Bischoff, I'm not even sure these days what his exact title and position is, but he's certainly a power player behind the scenes in TNA. He has more power now, creatively, than he did when he first came in. Remember when Eric Bischoff and Hulk Hogan first came to TNA? I remember this. And I remember specifically Bischoff saying that he was coming into TNA not to take over the company. He was not going to really have any power like that at all. That was not going to be his role. He was doing things with his own production company, Bischoff Hervey Entertainment. But, you know, where Hogan goes, Eric goes. And so that was the extent to which he would be involved. And, of course, a lot of people called bullshit at the time, which it was, and Bischoff has certainly collected a lot more power since then, or at least has decided to exercise the power that he already had, and he definitely is a big influence behind the scenes. So he goes on Twitter, or Facebook, or he has both. I guess he maybe tweet. Some people have the two of them connected, their Facebook and their Twitter, so when they send something out, it goes out on both. Regardless, he was doing some social networking this week, let's say that. And this is what he had to say. This is an exact quote from Eric Bischoff. He says, quote, "It seems like 90% of the audience loves what the loudest 10% hates. So who really matters? The 10%ers can't get over the fact that they are irrelevant. Ratings don't lie. Research doesn't lie. IWC, that being Internet Wrestling Community, smarks, need to get over it." End quote. So basically what Bischoff is saying is that we don't give a shit about the people who complain about our product on the internet. Well, that's nice. By the way, they don't care at all about these people, and yet How many times have we seen Bischoff take umbrage to something that somebody said on a podcast or somebody tweeted him or posted on Facebook, and then Bischoff will come back with some sort of rant? He'll go on Monday Night Mayhem show every week or every other week or whatever it is. And, you know, for a guy who doesn't care, he seems to waste an awful lot of time retorting and responding to people and insulting them. It gets under his skin. Don't say that it doesn't matter. It does matter to you. If you disagree with the people, then that's fine. You know, go head-to-head with them. Lock horns. But don't pretend like it doesn't bother you, because if it didn't bother you, you wouldn't waste your time rebutting whenever anybody writes back to you to say that you're full of shit. Which, of course, Eric Bischoff is. Eric Bischoff was full of shit 12 years ago, and Eric Bischoff is full of shit today. And the fact is, his statement is not 100% inaccurate. You know, to insinuate that the internet wrestling fans are the dominant majority kind of group of fans that have this great influence on the ratings and all of that stuff is absolutely not true. I don't think it's as low as some people says it is. Is it 10%? Is it 5%? 1%? 20%? Who the fuck knows? But I do think that they are an influential audience. And it is true, also, that it's very difficult to please them. I've said that before. You know, you can do something right for a change, or you can take the advice that people want you to do something. We want to see this match. We want you to push this guy. We want you to put more wrestling on TV and less entertainment. And if they do it, then those same people will find something else to complain about. That is true. I will give him that much. That is true. But when you're talking about the internet wrestling community in relation to a company like TNA, those are your diehard fans. TNA does not have the fan base all over the world that WWE has, in all the countries that WWE broadcasts to. And in fairness, WWE's been around for over 50, 60 years. TNA hasn't even been around a full decade yet. These are your diehard fans. You're insulting your fans, the ones that have stuck around through thick and thin, through all the bullshit over the years, the ones that have abandoned the product, sampled it, and they tuned out, all the people that continue to give you the 1.1 or the 1.2 on Spike TV every week. These are the people that Eric Bischoff is insulting, and he's saying that your opinion doesn't matter. We don't give a shit what you think. That's basically what he's saying. And that, in a nutshell, tells you everything you need to know about TNA and what they think of you. So when you support their product, just keep that in mind in the future. But you know what? Don't tell me anything. Let Eric Bischoff know how you think. You know, again, Eric Bischoff doesn't care, so he probably won't respond to your message. But I guarantee you that he will read it, it will get under his skin, and at some point, he's going to flip his lid, and he's going to go on another rant. Because it does bother them. They don't take criticism, in case you couldn't figure it out. These people don't generally take criticism very well. They're a bunch of interesting characters, these former wrestling promoters and people behind the scenes. They're very interesting personalities. Speaking of interesting personalities, that brings me to two of the biggest stars in the history of professional wrestling, Hulk Hogan and the Ultimate Warrior. Now, I was asked if I was going to comment on this, and I really wasn't. And even so, I still don't have that much to say. So I'm just going to touch on this briefly and move on. I have seen the YouTube videos that the Warrior did. In fact, I saw the first YouTube videos Warrior did recently were the two videos he did in tribute to the Macho Man, Randy Savage. And they were very classy, very well done. And the general consensus was people were very impressed by how Warrior came off in the videos. You know, he didn't come off as a raving lunatic or a nutcase or what the hell did he just say? It was a very classy tribute from one of Randy Savage's former colleagues and greatest opponents, really. I mean, Savage brought Warrior to the best matches of his career at SummerSlam and, more importantly, at WrestleMania 7. So you figure, all right, Warrior, perhaps he's mellowing out finally as he gets older. And in fact, that's not true. Warrior is still Warrior. God bless him. He started cutting videos on Hulk Hogan. Can't let this animosity just go with himself and Hogan. He just clearly doesn't like Hogan. I don't care if he claims, it's not that I hate Hogan. I didn't say Warrior hates Hogan, but clearly there's no love lost there. Warrior does not think much of Hulk Hogan or Terry Bollea as a man. Let's just agree on that. And Warrior cut this promo where he said that Karma, and I don't mean Awesome Kong, Karma was coming to collect on Hulk Hogan. So basically threatening that he would have something to reveal about the Hulkster very, very soon. And Warrior, since that time, has given some other updates that this video that he's promising to show us is almost complete. We may be able to see it as early as this week. It's supposedly like almost 2 hours long or something like this. I have no idea what he has up his sleeve. I have no idea what the Warrior is going to do. I have no idea what the Warrior is going to say. I wish him nothing but the best. I'm following him now on Twitter. It's very entertaining. But when I see the back and forth, you know, Hulk Hogan's been asked about it a lot on his Twitter, and so he's responded, and he's, you know, Hogan now is a very positive person. You know, he went through a lot of heavy shit in his life, and I guess, you know, like all wrestlers who do stupid shit, he found religion. I think he's born again, and, you know, he got this new tattoo on his back that says immortal, and he's just a very positive person. Hogan talks a lot about positive energy and positive vibes. He should have been a scientist. He keeps talking about, you know, vibes and energy, and, you know, it's like a physicist, this guy. So, of course, he's basically responded by saying, you know, we Hulkamaniacs don't care for other people's negativity, clearly taking pot shots at the Warrior on that. Here's my take on this. I don't give a shit about a feud between Hulk Hogan and the Ultimate Warrior in 2011. To me, it's very sad. I grew up a fan of Hulk Hogan. I was never like a huge fan of the Warrior, but again, Warrior as a character was, again, he was one of those characters like the Macho Man that I grew up with. He was a character. There's no denying that. And I have fond memories of the Ultimate Warrior character from my youth, even though I was always a Hogan fan. But to see the two of them going back and forth like this in their 50s in the year 2011 is pathetic. It is sad. It is a complete and total waste of time. It's not building to anything. It's two old men behaving very immaturely, I guess. You know, again, Hogan is just responding to what Warrior said. You can say, well, he started it, but I don't care who started it. Hogan is Hogan. With him, you know what you get. Warrior, I don't know. I don't quite know how to explain the Warrior. You know, he's a very intelligent guy, but he's also very, he's very eccentric, I guess is the right word. And again, I have no idea what he claims to have, what dirt he claims to dish on Hulk Hogan, and I don't care. I really don't care. And I don't want to talk about this really anymore. Depending on what he says, unless he comes out and has some unbelievable news about Hulk Hogan that absolutely must be discussed, to me, this just reeks of wanting attention and craving attention. Because Warrior has been out of the spotlight now for quite a while. And Hogan, well, Hogan is always looking for attention, no matter what. I just find it very, very sad, is the best way that I can describe it. And what I also find very sad is the notion that Hulk Hogan would, in any way, shape, or form, defend Brian Knobbs for mocking the death of Randy Savage on the day that Randy Savage died. See, that to me, when I talked about it last week and I called Brian Knobbs a tub of human goo, I did so because, first of all, he is, and I meant every word of it. That's number one. But number two, you know, to make fun of somebody like Randy Savage, who was revered by a lot of people, and even if you were in the wrestling business and you weren't friends with Randy Savage, maybe you didn't even care for him. Maybe, you know, Savage didn't necessarily get along with everybody. But to mock the man the day that he died, when everybody else is paying tribute and honor to him, is disgusting. And apparently somebody asked Hogan about it on Twitter, and he responded by saying something to the effect of, well, I would hope, or I assume that, you know, whatever Knobbs did, it was like Knobbs being Knobbs, and he probably did it as a joke, and people took it the wrong way. That may well be true. It may well be true. But that's no excuse. And Hogan, of all people, who ever since Savage died, Hogan is going on and on and on about, oh my God, I cannot get over the fact that Macho is gone. Me and him had just made up. We were friends again. First of all, nobody knows for sure, other than Hogan and Savage. And Savage ain't around no more. I was always a Hogan fan when I was younger. It's hard for me to rail on the guy too much. But anytime Hulk Hogan opens his mouth, even if Hulk Hogan opens his mouth to say hello, take it with a grain of salt. That's the lesson when it comes to Hulk Hogan and the stuff that he says. Do I believe that Hogan made amends with Randy Savage only recently, after all those years of animosity and all those years of Savage cutting promos on Hogan, talking trash about Hogan, not talking to Hogan, not wanting to be in the same promotion as Hogan? You know, even when Savage had that brief stint in TNA, you know, when Hogan was around or Hogan came in, because Hogan was in some way affiliated with TNA very briefly himself back then, Savage wanted to have no part of it. He claimed unsafe working conditions. He didn't want to be around Hogan. Did the two of them really make up? I don't know. I tend to believe not. There was no indication that the two of them had any communication whatsoever. Is it possible? Of course it's possible. But just take whatever Hogan says with a grain of salt. But if he is to be believed, Hulk Hogan, of all people, should be pissed at Brian Knobbs for saying stupid shit like that. And yet, nope, he's his buddy, he has to defend him. And while that is noble, it's also pretty fucking stupid, because there is no defending what Brian Knobbs did. He's a walking turd. So, not a good week for Hulk Hogan. Didn't make himself look very good. And this Hogan Warrior stuff, again, I know people are interested in it. They're two very big names. And we'll see what comes out from Warrior's end. But I'm not lying when I tell you that I really, really could care less about this. And I just wish the two of them would just keep their mouths shut, move on with their lives. They're not doing their legacies and their images any good by, you know, going back and forth like this. It's very juvenile. Couple of other things here. I got to bring this up. China has been in the news this week. I'm sure many of you are aware by now. China, of course, wrestled at the Sacrifice pay-per-view for TNA only a matter of weeks ago. She teamed up with Kurt Angle to take on Jeff and Karen Jarrett. And she had a, you know, an okay showing for herself in that match. I saw the match. There was one spot in the match where she went to give Jeff Jarrett a body slam and almost just killed the guy. It just almost dropped him on his head. But then she did a suplex that looked pretty good, and she did the pedigree in the match, whoever's idea that was. And whatever, it was a one-and-done appearance. China was not at the TNA tapings the next time, and it was seemingly going to be a one-shot deal. And then apparently news came out that they were actually negotiating on a longer-term deal to work together. Because, you know, when China was there, she behaved well, she showed up, she did what she was asked to do. And there was a lot of talk in TNA about bringing her in to do something on a more permanent basis. And then the news came out that Vivid Entertainment was marketing a film called Backdoor into China, which is, of course, doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out, a porn film. Now, China's done porn before, but not officially. She, of course, did that sex tape with Sean Waltman many years ago that left scars in my memory that will never go away. They will never heal. And so now she's made it to the big time. You know, Vivid Entertainment is a professionally run company, and that's what they do. They market pornography. And I don't know when she shot this film. I don't care. If you are into that sort of thing, SE Scoops had some still shots up from apparently the trailer of the movie. You know, I of course, do frequent SE Scoops, as many of you did. Do, I should say, and saw some of the images. And from the TNA side, The story here is that they have severed negotiations with China as a result of this news coming out of her porn film. And China was upset about this and said basically, well, it's TNA's loss. They're really missing the boat. And here's the deal with China. I hope that she makes a lot of money off this movie. And apparently she wants to do more of them. She wants to become a full-time porn actress, or so says TMZ.com. That's great. And like I said, some people think she's attractive. Some people are into that sort of thing. Well, hey, some people are into snuff films. Some people are into necrophilia. Some people are into bestiality. Those same people, I guess, are into seeing China. That's fine. To me, she looks like something that you'd have to kill in a video game to advance to the next level. And I just don't see what the appeal is to China. You know, once upon a time, when she first came into WWF and she was, quote, discovered, she was not a very attractive woman. And clearly she felt the same way, because she felt the need to have plastic surgery and really doll herself up and make herself look more feminine. I think that's really what it was. She was big into bodybuilding, and clearly she was using steroids and chemical enhancement, because it's not natural to have a physique like that. As prevalent as steroid use is in men's bodybuilding, it is every bit as prevalent in women's bodybuilding. It's just that women tend to use different steroids than men. Actually, I shouldn't even say that because a lot of men will take female hormones and stuff like that, actually. But nonetheless, Chyna was not happy with her appearance, and she went through a transformation. And she looked better. And then over the years, she didn't treat her body very well, and she's fallen on some tough times. And again, not my cup of tea. But I suppose some people, to them, perhaps it is. Good for you. If you're a TNA fan, you won't have to worry about any back door or front door into Chyna because they ain't bringing her back. I don't think they should have brought her in to begin with. You know, the woman is a train wreck waiting to happen. And TNA likes getting in bed with people who apparently fit that description. They've done it many times before. We shouldn't be surprised, but they have closed that door. And so apparently Chyna has taken the back door. And I wish her nothing but the best. Lastly here, Gabe Sapolsky, who is the booker for Evolve Wrestling and the former booker for Ring of Honor, penned an editorial on Paul Heyman's website, the Heyman Hustle, HeymanHustle.com, a couple of days ago, pushing the idea, the very interesting idea, of having Shaquille O'Neal, the retired NBA superstar, wrestle a match at WrestleMania in Miami next year. Of course, Shaq has a lot of fans in Miami. He played a couple of seasons for the Miami Heat, and is one of the best big men in the history of the NBA. He just announced his retirement. Shaq, of course, is a huge wrestling fan. I still remember Shaq making an appearance back in 1994 at the Bash at the Beach when Hulk Hogan had his first WCW match. That was the title win over Ric Flair. Shaq was there. Mr. T was there. I think George Foreman might have been there, but Shaq is a huge fan, makes no bones about it, and he's made a couple of WWE appearances over the years. He had something many years back with Carlito, and I think he hit Carlito with a chair backstage, and he was one of the better guest hosts in the history of Raw when we went through that phase of celebrity guest hosts. And they were even teasing the idea of a possible match between Shaq and the Big Show, which never did happen. But now Shaq is free. He's no longer an NBA player. He's retired. He can pretty much do whatever he wants. And the idea that Gabe pushes in this editorial is not for a Shaq-Big Show match, which you might expect it would be for, but rather he pushes for a match between Shaq and CM Punk, which is a very interesting storyline. Now, Punk, of course, is a lot smaller than Shaq. I mean, a lot smaller in height, weight, and just about every way conceivable. But Punk is awesome. He's a great wrestler. He's got a great mind for the business, and he makes money with his mouth. He's one of the best promo guys in the business, and it's unfortunate that it looks like Punk is on his way out. He is off the booking sheets as of the end of July, so we could be seeing the end of CM Punk as early as the end of next month. If he left, he would probably be leaving, just to take a sabbatical for however long, kind of like Chris Jericho. It could be a couple months. It could be a year. It could be 2 years. I would not expect Punk to go to TNA or anything like that, but if he is going to be gone for a while, then that's bad news for us, because Punk is a very big part of that Raw brand. But if Punk either doesn't leave or perhaps comes back in time for WrestleMania next year, basically the story that Gabe pushes in the editorial is such that, Shaq wants to become a wrestler, and I think Steve Austin is involved in the storyline, in that Austin agrees to train Shaq, because, of course, Austin is the head trainer on Tough Enough. So who else to go to but one of the greatest stars in the history of the business, Stone Cold Steve Austin. And basically Punk would, I think the story is that Punk would get involved in some way and would injure Austin at some point and, injure his neck. And this would lead to Shaq challenging Punk to a match. And the way that he lays it out, it's very bare bones, but I am intrigued by the idea. It certainly is an interesting idea, and if you could convince them to do this, and Shaq was willing to do it and Punk was going to be around, it would give Punk the highest profile match of his entire career, number one. It would make Punk a mainstream name by pushing him as the opponent for Shaquille O'Neal in Shaq's one and perhaps only wrestling match. And if you could headline WrestleMania with that match next year in Miami, I mean, we know the one match that is the real headline attraction is going to be John Cena and The Rock. But Shaq versus Punk with Austin involved in some way in Miami, of all places, would be one hell of a co-main event. And on top of that, you got The Undertaker going for 20-0 in potentially his last match at WrestleMania. You've got three blockbuster matches to promote for WrestleMania 28 next year. So it's an interesting idea. You can head over to HeymanHustle.com, check it out, and let me know what you think about the idea. What would you think of Shaq being involved in WWE in some way for an angle, for one match, or if he wanted to pursue perhaps more than one match? You know, Floyd Mayweather, when he did that match with Big Show at WrestleMania years ago, talked about becoming a WWE star once he retired from boxing. And I thought it was bullshit at the time because there's much more money for him to be made in boxing. And Mayweather in recent years has not expressed any interest in coming over to WWE. But Shaq is an interesting case. You know, he's a very, like I said, he knows the business. He's a very charismatic guy. He's a big dude. And his body may not be able to withstand the same rigors on the basketball court that it once did, but in wrestling, if he's protected and used for one or two matches, that could be huge for WWE. So check that out. Let me know what you think. All right, it's mailbag time, and I have got a lot more stories from you guys about how you became fans of pro wrestling. I think I have enough of them right now to last me a lifetime. Of course, you can still email me if you want to, but I can no longer make a guarantee that your story will get on the air, but certainly if you would like to share it, by all means, thesolemnmonster@gmail.com. This one comes from Russell in London. It says, it was the late 1980s, and in the UK, you cannot see wrestling on terrestrial television, so at school we would collect the cards that came with a stick of bubble gum and read the official magazine occasionally. The only way you could see WWF was via the VHS releases, which were at least 6 months behind, maybe a year. I remember being fascinated by the Undertaker character when he materialized and being genuinely terrified by the funeral parlor interviews with Paul Bearer. Being a kid, I was drawn to the hero figures like Hulk Hogan and the Ultimate Warrior. Well, that's ironic, considering I just talked about them earlier. Eventually, a friend with a richer family got satellite television and insisted that the Undertaker had beaten Hogan for the title. I refused to believe it until several months later when I saw it myself on VHS. By this point, I was hooked, reading the magazines as often as I could afford to do so, until thankfully my grandparents invested in satellite television, and I got to witness the joys of the Brooklyn Brawler jobbing out on a weekly basis. Everybody rags on the current PG product, and I certainly prefer the edgier times as a young male, but as I reach the age when I will begin having a family of my own, it's nice to think that just as I used to watch the comic characters like the Mountie with my granddad, the current style of product will enable me to enjoy it again with my kids. That comes from Russell in London, and he makes a very good point about PG. You know, I personally am not a fan of PG. If I had a choice, I wouldn't say I'd go back to the way things were in 1998, but I would certainly push for a much edgier, more adult product. But the point he makes is a very good one. You know, you've got a lot of people either with kids or who are planning on having kids, and they want to watch wrestling, or they want their son or even their daughter to be fans as well. But you reach that age where you see, you know, your young child in your arms, and it really does give you a whole new perspective on life. I've heard that from a lot of people. It just changes your entire worldview. Everything is not about you anymore. It's about them. You want the best for them. And some people don't care, and, you know, they may let their three-year-old son watch WWE. But a lot of people are not going to do that. I mean, even during the Attitude Era, when Vince McMahon would be interviewed or Linda McMahon would be interviewed, and they would be asked, you know, if you had a young child, a 6-year-old child, a 9-year-old child, would you let them watch the product? And Vince didn't shy away from the question. He said, unequivocally, absolutely not. Because, you know, even he knew that it wasn't a product that was geared towards kids. So it's kind of, you know, you can go both ways on this. Some people want attitude and they don't give a crap because, you know, they don't have to worry about that sort of thing. And other people, they have kids or they have family or whatever, and it's a big deal to them. So I understand both sides of the argument. Paul Munn writes in from Luton, England. I remember I was about 11, and my brother was a fan who had been watching since the early 1990s. He sat me down, and we watched SummerSlam, or rather Survivor Series, I should say. 1997, Gang Rules. And I love the match between The Nation against the LOD, Shamrock, and Ahmed Johnson. Also, I remember Stone Cold Steve Austin against Owen Hart, which I think was my favorite match, and the Bret Hart vs. Shawn Michaels Montreal Screwjob. Can you think of a more confusing first pay-per-view for a new fan trying to work out the business, and it's because of the intrigue and action on this show that got me hooked? So there you go. That I can see where that would be a little bit confusing if you were not really a wrestling fan And imagine watching the end of that Shawn Michaels-Bret Hart match for the first time. Watching Earl Hebner call for the bell, and everybody's all confused, and Shawn Michaels, who just won the championship for a third time, is leaving the ring with the belt, and he looks like he just lost. And you can easily see where people would be confused by that. David writes in to the show from Northern Ireland. Been listening since I got my first iPod in September, and I discovered the podcast for the first time. I remember well how I got into wrestling. I was 9 years old and at a friend's house, and he had the video of WrestleMania 4. I think what attracted me to it was that I had never seen a double video box like that before. It's funny you mention that, because I actually have that same thing here. It's the old Coliseum video, and what they did for WrestleMania 4 was it was two tapes, because it was a four-hour show. And so it was two tapes kind of stacked one on top of the other, and you open them, and in the middle, a Hulk Hogan pop-up popped out at you. I mean, just roided and jacked up to the gills. I still have it downstairs, actually. It's a collector's item here. I'm never going to let that go. Anyway, David says, I asked if we could watch it, and after seeing the Macho Man's four-match run in the tournament to win the championship, I was hooked. And just the whole spectacle of everything put me in awe. So that comes from David. Severio from Orlando writes in, I've been a fan of pro wrestling for over two decades now, but I still remember when it all started. I was staying with my grandparents for the weekend and woke up early to watch Saturday morning cartoons. This was in the 80s, mind you, and while channel surfing, I came across the old WWF animated show. I found Hulk Hogan, Junkyard Dog, and Roddy Piper's antics quite comical, so I decided to watch the live shows and was even more hooked. But the moment that sealed the deal was a few years later when I saw the debut of The Undertaker. Being born on Halloween, I felt a link with that character, and I have been a mark ever since. John in Northern Ireland, another Northern Ireland listener, writes in here, his parents took away Sky TV from him back in the day since they thought it would just keep them in the house all day. He remembers having a WWF lunchbox about 1998 or 99 with the Scratch logo, Chris Jericho, and Steve Austin on it, and can remember this girl he knew being a big wrestling fan. Since he had no way of watching it, she would update me with the latest storylines. In fact, I could still envision hearing about Kane burying The Undertaker at the 2003 Survivor Series. From there, I purchased the WWE video games to learn more about wrestling. In October of 05, I got the internet and was able to keep up with current product using WWE.com and YouTube. I still remember the first main article I ever saw on the front page of WWE.com with Booker T and Charmel celebrating after having beaten Chris Benoit for the United States Championship on SmackDown. So as you can tell, I have no idea when I became a wrestling fan, and there is no one incident where I suddenly became a diehard. The real journey for me was trying to find a way to keep up with it, and of course the true irony is after all these years of searching for a way, I sometimes don't even want to watch it anymore. In 2007, I discovered the Sound Off, after almost walking out on wrestling considering how bad the year 2007 was as a whole. And my passion for wrestling was reset. I haven't missed a Sound Off since then because your words truly show me why I put up with this insanity. Because when pro wrestling done correctly, it is the most exciting, hilarious, sad, or heartwarming of television products. Amen to that. That comes from John in Northern Ireland. Derek Fox writes into the Sound Off here. He's been listening since somewhere between episode 50 and 60. Says, when the question was asked, when did you become a wrestling fan, I instantly knew the answer. For me, it's hand down has to be the Shawn Michaels versus British Bulldog match on November 8th, 1992, Saturday night's main event. I was well on my way to becoming an 8-year-old at the time and was completely blown away by what I saw. That dastardly HBK taking the turnbuckle cover off and whipping Davey Boy into the exposed steel, and then the superplex finish. Shawn winning his first Intercontinental title when it actually meant something. It was at that moment that I completely fell in love with the business and have been hooked ever since. Keep up that fine auditory bliss, Solid Monster. Auditory bliss, that's a first. I've heard audio crack before, but not auditory bliss. Maybe we can come up with some other ones. Steven from Norfolk, Nebraska writes in, I don't remember exactly when I became a fan of wrestling because I was so young, but I'm now 5 months away from turning 26, and I remember every night when wrestling was on, my grandfather and I would get together early in the day and just eat hot dogs all day. Those were my most favorite days of the week. My grandfather passed away back in 2004 due to a stroke while I was in high school, and I was watching wrestling to reminisce about my times with him, but boy, oh boy, how times have changed. I feel like I might have actually read this one before, but I think Steven resubmitted it because he didn't put his name and information in there. So if that's the second time I've shared that, then I apologize. But there you go. That's from Steven. He says, P.S., your show is to me what cookies are to the Cookie Monster. It's some really good stuff. Thank you. Steve in Ontario, Canada, says, when I became a wrestling fan, it was in my grade 9 year of high school. My friend came over one day after school, and the Raw replay was on. I'm from Canada, and back in those days, WWF, as it used to be, aired on TSN, live on Mondays, and would replay the following day at 4 o'clock. My buddy told me to put it on because he missed the night before. This resulted in a brief argument. Now, when I was a child, every now and then I would see wrestling here and there as if I was ever over someone's house. Every time I would question it and say to myself that it wasn't real, I remember one particular instance where I was at my cousin's, and they had ordered the Royal Rumble event, where Undertaker gave the infamous promo from the coffin. That would have been 1994. And I would say to myself that this is stupid and can't possibly be real. So needless to say, I had zero interest as a child, while other kids loved it. I guess like today, I always questioned it, but going back to where my friend told me to turn to it, I finally gave in and even remember saying, fine, let's watch this fake crap. Well, fake or not, I was hooked. I still remember that episode, by the way. It was the one where China betrayed Triple H by giving him a low blow and going over to the corporation. I think that was actually the night after the 1999 Royal Rumble, if I remember correctly. And I think, going on memory here, I think Triple H had Rock on the announce desk and was going to give him a pedigree. And China was being threatened with physical harm, I think. And Triple H, I remember it was an I Quit match, playing off the I Quit match that Rock had the night before with Mankind. And Triple H reluctantly said, I quit, went to help China, and that's when she turned on him. So at least I hope that's what happened, because that's what I remember. Anyway, Steve continues here, not the most memorable Raw moment, but I was hooked from that point and have been watching ever since. Is wrestling fake? Of course. Matches are predetermined and storylines are fake as hell, but I did not care. I was entertained. Am I entertained these days? Of course not. I find myself falling asleep during Raw more times than I care to remember, but that is a whole other subject that has been touched on many times. Keep up the great work. You really know your stuff when it comes to the wrestling world. You do a better job at it than anybody, and that is why we listen. So I appreciate that. It is from Steve in Ontario, up north in Canada. This little tale here comes from Isaiah. The first pro wrestling memory I have is WrestleMania 1. Actually, my father was at WrestleMania 1, now that I think about it. He and my grandfather were actually at Madison Square Garden for the first WrestleMania. And I know around here somewhere I still have an original WrestleMania 1 black T-shirt with the WWF WrestleMania logo on it. And I would totally wear that now, but unfortunately it's it would look like an action figure shirt on my body, which would not be a good look for me. So, but anyway, Isaiah was a fan back in the day, WrestleMania 1 being his earliest memory, and he was 7 years old at that time and remembers being mad at his father for not taking him to see it on closed-circuit television. I was obsessed and watched as much wrestling as humanly possible, Saturday night's main event, World Class on WWOR-TV, and when I was lucky, and at a family member's house, NWA and AWA on cable. I stopped watching during my teenage years, only to fall back in love in 1995 when, as a high school senior and enjoying RVD and Paul London's favorite controlled substance, I stumbled upon Tommy Dreamer hitting Raven with a chair shot heard round the world. ECW, the real ECW, not the abomination that Vince tried to bring back, was my favorite promotion ever. It had it all. High flyers, tag teams, garbage matches, and some of the greatest performers of the decade. I enjoyed the Big Two as well, but liked WCW more with the NWO Sting angle. That was pretty cool. Until the shitty payoff. I enjoyed WWF talent like Austin Rock and DX, but always felt that Vince's show was ECW light. But watched both Monday night shows anyway. Right now, Ring of Honor is my favorite promotion, and I try to see the shows that come to New York City. So that comes from Isaiah. And, you know, it's an interesting point that he says when he thinks that WWF back in the Attitude Era was like ECW light, because it really was in many ways. You just cannot deny that Eric Bischoff and Vince McMahon both stole concepts from the original ECW. And they did it very well. They incorporated it into their current product and brought in millions of new fans. But the people who don't think that the original ECW had any sort of lasting, legitimate impact on the wrestling industry as a whole, including Eric Bischoff, who I'm sure would probably subscribe to that same theory, I'd like to know what they're smoking, quite frankly, because to anybody with a brain who used to watch both products at the time, and even looking back on it now, you can see the fingerprints of the old ECW all over WWF and WCW, especially WWF. And so I think ECW probably deserves a lot more credit for that than they get, even all these years later. Akash from Long Island, New York writes in, he became a fan in 1999. He was only 4 years old. His father would bring old WWF tapes after work and would watch them every night. Him and his twin brothers' favorite wrestlers at the time were The Rock and Stone Cold. My mother used to videotape us for home videos, and in almost every single one of them, I would imitate The Rock's catchphrases all the time. Watching wrestling even then, when I was a toddler, was a thrill of a lifetime and can never be duplicated again, especially when you're growing up in the Attitude Era. I learned a lot of vulgar language during that time, and all the trouble was worth it, because we will always cherish those old exciting moments from the WWF. Glenn from Orlando has a question. Is there a reason Michael Cole keeps spouting that he's reading a message from an iPad when the moron is clearly looking at a laptop? WWE has been using Apple's sound for the Raw GM ding. Did Apple pay WWE to say iPad or something? And if they're willing to pay that much, why can't they just get WWE a freaking iPad to stick in Cole's glass box? Well, he doesn't have the glass box anymore, but anyway, better yet, why can't WWE just spend the $500 and get one themselves? It's not like the cost of an iPad will make Alberto Del Rio have to show up in the ring in a Prius or something. Very animated, Glenn in Orlando, very upset about that. I'd be more upset about the fact that every time Michael Cole or Josh Matthews reads from the supposed laptop a message from the Raw GM, and they're supposed to be reading the screen, they clearly are reading from a piece of paper on the keyboard of the screen. And that's fine, but the camera always manages to get a shot where it's so blatantly obvious. I'm not sure if they just think it's a joke that we're not all in on, or if they're just too stupid to realize it. That pisses me off more than anything else. Justin Santiago wants to know, why is R-Truth not allowed into Canada? How long will it take for him to be allowed again into the country? Well, he sent me this question on May 25th, which was just, what, a week and a half ago? Maybe 2 weeks ago? And in that time, apparently R-Truth has settled whatever issues he had with gaining entry into Canada, because he had a previous offense on his record. I believe it was a felony many years ago. And that was what was causing him to be allowed, or rather denied, access to the country. He was not allowed to enter into Canada because of that. And I don't know what he did or what WWE did recently, but obviously they did something because it got worked out. And he actually just appeared, I think, at a house show in Canada within the last week or two. And so that's a good thing, because I've said before that, you know, one of the things I felt might have been holding him back was the fact that he wasn't allowed to travel to Canada. I mean, any superstar that has any sort of felony or any sort of record that would prevent them entry into countries like Canada and Japan, which is another one that's very strict about things like that. Booker T, for example, either still can't or for the longest time could not go to Japan for that very same reason. You know, he was arrested when he was much younger. But it's one of those things where it will hold you back. You cannot have somebody, for example, being the world champion or the face of your promotion or company, who is expected to travel all over the world, not only to just compete, but also to do PR and media and things of that nature. And if you have somebody with a criminal record who is not even allowed into the country, that's not going to fly. So thankfully, R-Truth got this worked out, and who knows, perhaps there's a world title in his future. Trust writes in. He says that he's been looking at the comments section on a recent Benoit article, Chris Benoit article that was posted on SE Scoops, and there's been a real mix of opinion. I feel that he does not deserve some of the stuff people say and write about him, or the way that WWE acts like he didn't exist. What do you think? Does Benoit deserve to be written out of the history books? Benoit should not be written out of the history books, because history is what it is. You know, if Chris Benoit won this championship on this date from this person, and you have a title history, like even in the title histories on WWE.com, I'm pretty sure Chris Benoit is listed in there. You know, it's not like his name on that particular webpage will link to a nice bio of him. It's just the name Chris Benoit. I'm pretty sure they still list him in there. But anyway, you can't erase him from the quote history books if they actually existed. But he deserves everything that has been written about him. You know, he killed two people. He killed his wife, he killed his kid, and then he killed himself. And it's one thing to kill yourself, or you know, another human being in an accident, let's say. And again, we'll never know exactly what happened that day, but the fact remains that he killed two people and himself, and he caused much grief and harm to come to the wrestling industry. And you can argue the same thing in the opposite way, that the wrestling industry caused quite a bit of harm to Chris Benoit in his life. But the fact is, what he did cannot be forgiven. And I have no problem with WWE not acknowledging him, not honoring him in any way. He did what he did and made his own bed. And it's unfortunate. It's sad. He was very talented. It's not as though because of what he did that makes him not talented. But it also means that WWE does not have to put themselves in a position to honor his legacy or acknowledge him on television or on their videos if they don't want to. It's annoying. Yes. You know, to watch old episodes of Nitro that are clearly edited to, you know, get every mention of him out of there. Every now and then he'll slip in there somehow, but I have no problem with it. You know, Benoit did what he did, and, you know, there's nothing that can be done to change that. And it doesn't get much worse than what he did, and I have no problem with it. Blackleg from the Philippines writes in. He has been a fan of the Sound Off now for a little while, and he wanted to commend me on the tearjerker of a Sound Off 160. You never fail to deliver. Well, I appreciate that. Came from the heart. And his question is, do I think Averno, who, of course, I think I mentioned last week, is coming over from the CMLL promotion to compete in WWE as an opponent for Sin Cara. He was one of Sin Cara's greatest opponents down in Mexico, and Sin Cara personally handpicked him to be signed to come in to feud with. And his question basically is, could Averno be the next Takamichi Noku, the Mexican equivalent to him, if you will? If I remember correctly, you once mentioned on the show that Taka was brought in to help get the great Sasuke over, but instead it was Taka who went on to have a 9-year run in WWE. With all the botched moves and backstage heat, do you think Averno will come in and steal Sin Cara's thunder and roster spot? Well, I don't think he will. And I hope that he carves out a nice little career for himself and that WWE is not just going to bring him in to feud with Sin Cara, beat him, and then have nothing for him, because for him that would suck. He is a big star down in Mexico. And I don't claim to be an expert on Averno's career, because I'm not, but I do know he's a big deal down there, and he's had quite a bit of success, and he's built up his name. And to think that he would come to WWE, even if they were paying him good money, just to lose to Sin Cara and then they have nothing for him, or they send him down to developmental, or he becomes a jobber to the stars on Superstars, that would suck. Now, I did say before, because the story is true, that when they brought the great Sasuke over to WWE in 1997, they were promoting a match at the Canadian Stampede pay-per-view that July. One of the best pay-per-views, by the way, that WWE has ever done in its history. And he was supposed to face Taka Michinoku, who they were bringing in from Japan. And the plan was not to push Taka as anything special, but Taka was going to get a great match out of Sasuke, and he was really the one who was on display. It was the great Sasuke. And what ended up happening was just the opposite, which is not to say that great Sasuke had a bad performance, but Taka Michinoku blew him out of the water. He was very impressive in that match, and he opened up a lot of eyes. And so what ended up happening is great Sasuke had little or no further involvement with WWE, and they signed Taka to a contract. And I think I've said before, there was even a press conference at the time where Vince McMahon and Jim Ross were there, and it was a big deal. You know, when they signed Sin Cara, it reminded me of that. You know, they had a press conference down in Mexico for him. Jim Ross was there. And I could not remember them making a big deal about somebody like this with a press conference in the whole nine yards, especially a small guy, since they did it with Taka Michinoku back in 97-98. So, is Averno going to be the next Taka? I don't think he will be, in that I don't think he'll steal Sin Cara's thunder. If he becomes a success, I don't think it will be at Sin Cara's expense. I think they have a lot invested in Sin Cara. And you know what? For all this talk about botched moves and heat backstage, yes, he has some heat. He was a big star in Mexico, okay? He was the John Cena or the Rey Mysterio of Mexico. Some people don't understand that. And he is a guy who you've heard stories about him that make it sound like he's also the Hulk Hogan of Mexico. And that's not a good thing. He's got a big chip on his shoulder. And that tends to rub a lot of people the wrong way, especially when you come to the States and you come to WWE and you're the new guy and you think your shit don't stink. You tend to rub people the wrong way. That's all true. But he's a very talented performer. who I think was thrown onto television a little quicker than he should have been. And it's just going to take him a little bit longer to acclimate. But I think it may take weeks. It may take months. For all the money they invested in him, and they put this big press release out that said that he was Triple H's first acquisition, as Triple H is now heading this new division of developmental, and they're not going to give up on Sin Cara so quickly. And he's talented enough that it won't take much longer for him to really get the hang of things. I'm not a fan of that lighting they have during his matches. That's not his fault. But they're doing that to showcase him. You know, they're doing it because they want people's attention on him during the match. They want to spotlight him as something special. And I respect that and can appreciate it. But again, I think the lighting is a little much. I don't think that that's necessary. And much like Kane, when he first came into the company and they had all the arena lights off and just one red light on the ringside area during his matches, I don't think that's going to last much longer before they ditch that. But I don't think Averno will be a big star at his expense. If he becomes a big star, he'll be a big star in addition, because I think Sin Cara is going to be doing big things in WWE. And to me, all roads lead to a big one-on-one match, perhaps at WrestleMania next year, between him and Rey Mysterio, with Mysterio kind of passing the torch. I think that's ultimately where this leads with Sin Cara. Mark writes in with a serious question. What would you need to go to college for to be a writer for WWE or TNA? Well, one of the things they look for is a background in creative writing of some kind, or television writing, script writing. If you really are serious about wanting to become a writer for WWE or TNA, and hey, if you want to be a writer for TNA, I wish you all the luck in the world. If somebody listening to this show one day replaces Vince Russo, then God bless you. But as far as that or WWE is concerned, I've heard nothing but nightmare stories about the people who work for Vince and creative in WWE. It is a thankless job. The turnover rate is astronomical, which basically just means that when you get hired, you don't last very long before they bring in somebody new to replace you. So job security is far from a guarantee, and it's a 24/7 job. And Vince McMahon is notorious. I mean, he'll, you know, 3 o'clock in the morning, he'll call a meeting of the writers. If he's, you know, his brain is going and he's thinking of ideas, it doesn't matter to him. You know, your world, your life revolves around that job. When you have it. So just a word of warning there. But if it's something that you really feel passionately about, I would never dissuade somebody from wanting to do it. You're going to have a degree. I mean, the way I look at it is, in 2011, having a college degree, it's like college is the new high school, in that you're almost expected to have a college degree, a bachelor's degree like I have. You know, I didn't get a master's or anything, which is, you know, more impressive. But in my field, you know, it's one of those things that I just don't view as being a necessity. And again, you know, grad school is very expensive. But a bachelor's degree, not to diminish it at all, but it's almost like if it's just assumed that you have one. You put your resume out there and you want to get a good job. College is the new high school. You are expected to at least be at that level. And if you're not, you're already behind the pack. So whatever you major in, whatever your area of interest is, it's very important to make sure you, at the very least, have a college degree. And if you want to go into that particular field, I would not say go to college to become a WWE writer. I would say go to college and study whatever it is that really excites you, and study something that you yourself can see yourself doing for the rest of your life, whether it's writing, maybe it's something else. But take some courses in creative writing. You know, or script writing or something like that, because typically when there is a job posting for an opening on the creative team, I mean, a lot of times they look for Hollywood people. So again, you're already at a disadvantage. Unless you have already had a number of years experience writing scripts for pilots and TV shows and things like that in Hollywood, you're already going to be behind the eight ball. But that's the area that I would focus on the most. And who knows, you know, whenever there's a job opening, you put your application in, and perhaps you'll be sitting opposite Stephanie McMahon interviewing at Titan Tower. And if you ever do, just tell them that the Solomonster says hello. And one more question here. E. Byrne writes in, why are so many professional reporters / fans of pro wrestling up and down on ratings? With it being 2011 now, the average home averaging 200-plus channels, DVR, TiVo, YouTube, streaming video, and podcasts, I think at least 7 million people are watching wrestling, even though about 5 million watch live. What are your thoughts? First of all, I don't think 7 million is an accurate number. I don't think it's quite that high. I think what you're doing is a typical episode of Raw, let's say, on average, will get about 5 million viewers. And if you factor in the, let's say, 1.5 million additional viewers that TNA gets, perhaps you would come to that number. But many of those TNA fans, not all, but many of them, already watch WWE. So you can't count them as separate wrestling fans. So there's no fully 100% accurate statistic. Back in the day during the Monday Night Wars, you had a legit 10 million plus people at any given moment watching wrestling. So even if the number was 7 million, that's a difference of 3 million people that vanished in the last decade. And again, I don't think the number is quite as high as 7 million. So your numbers are a little bit off. And there are plenty of wrestling fans out there. There always will be. There are millions of wrestling fans out there. But the issue is there are many millions that disappeared because they weren't being satisfied by what they were seeing on television. And I'll tell you what, a lot of those people, I don't know if it was 3 million or anything like that, but there were a lot of fans who died as wrestling fans when WCW died. And some of them did sample WWF right afterwards. They were hopeful that WCW would live on in some way, shape, or form. And when they realized that that was not going to happen, they gave up. And they never came back. And some of them perhaps came back on January 4th of 2010. Remember the big Monday Night War impact move to Monday nights? They were going head-to-head with Raw. That first show, Bret Hart was coming back to WWF for the first time in 12 years, and they had Hulk Hogan and Eric Bischoff. You know, Hogan was making his debut on Impact, I think in the same quarter hour, actually. It was like the first time in over a decade that I was flipping channels feverishly, and it actually felt exciting again to be a wrestling fan. And the ratings for that night were big. That first hour of that three-hour Impact show did like a 1.7 or something, for them, something ridiculous like that. And Raw's rating was I think, pretty much average for them. But still, close to, if not 5 million people for Raw. So that was a big night for wrestling. And then what happened is within 2 or 3 weeks, the ratings for Impact tapered off because people sampled it. They you know, their interest was piqued. Their curiosity was there. And they didn't like what they saw. And they gave up and they went away in droves. So I think, again, are wrestling fans overly negative? Yes. Yes, I've said this before. I don't deny that. Am I overly negative? Well, I'll let you decide that. I don't think I'm negative for the sake of being negative. I think I'm negative because I have a good reason to be negative. And when there's no good reason to be negative, I'm positive. But there's no denying the fact that there were far more wrestling fans back in the day than there are now. And I think the argument that wrestling is a cyclical industry, I don't buy it. You know, even if the bell curve were there, I don't think that's an indication of anything. I think perhaps the industry has gone through cycles of interest before, but if the industry was cyclical, we'd be already up, way up, by now. And we're not. And all you got to do is give people what they want to see. And I don't understand for the life of me why it's so difficult many times for a wrestling promoter, whether your name is Vince McMahon or Dixie Carter or whoever, to just give the people what they want. And keep it simple, less is more. Put on the best product you can possibly put on with the best people. Which, again, that's what frustrates me when I see somebody like Daniel Bryan jobbing out on TV every week, if he even gets on TV, while they push people like Mason Ryan. It's, you know, it's always been that way, and I don't see it changing anytime soon. But as a fan, that kind of shit frustrates me big time. So, anyway, there you go. So that's going to do it for the mailbag this week. We'll cinch this bad boy back up. There's a lot more where that came from, but I'll save some for next week. You can always email me at thesolemonster@gmail.com. If I don't get to it on the air, I do read everything, and we'll hopefully respond either directly or over the air. So email me, twitter.com/solemonster is the Twitter address. We're up close to 850 followers and counting. And facebook.com/thesolemonster. I will be forever indebted to you if you recommend friends and colleagues and other people to friend me on Facebook and Twitter and sample the show. Perhaps they'll like it. I've gotten emails from a lot of people that have said that they've had friends or family members, some of whom are not even fans of wrestling, who listen to the show and they love the shit out of it. And I can't tell you how much that tickled me when I hear that. So I love hearing stories like that. So keep spreading the good word. You can subscribe to the show, as always, in iTunes. It's free. It doesn't cost you 99 cents like an app. It doesn't cost you a thing, actually, except maybe an hour and a half of your time. And hopefully you'll find it time well spent. So definitely check that out if you are not already subscribed on iTunes. We'll be back with another show next week. I think that's number 163. We keep inching up. And until next time, be well. Stay safe. Thanks for listening. We'll see you right back here next week.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joel from Northern Ireland.
Hi, I'm AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solar Monster sounds off on scscoops.com.